What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devinder Hardwar. This week I'm joined by podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. It is an exciting week because we got a surprise hardware drop from one of the squirreliest companies, the most like secretive companies out there, Valve. Valve announced three new devices, the new Steam Machine, which is a little console-like box, the Steam Frame VR headset, and the new Steam controller. We're going to be talking about all of that and our favorite games with Engadget's resident gaming expert, Jessica Condit. So stay tuned for all of that. We've got a bunch of news to dive into as well. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. And join us Thursday mornings, typically around 10:30 a.m. Eastern, on our YouTube channel for our live stream. I see folks there now. We've got some regulars. We can show off gadgets. I really wish I had any of these Steam gadgets to show off because they look adorable and they also look really, really interesting. All right. Joining us today is Jessica Condit, Engadget's gaming reporter. Hey, Jess, how's it going?
Hey, going all right.
Jess, I want to talk with you about all the game stuff, but our chat reminded us that one of the most important products of 2025 and potentially 2026 has been announced this week, and that is Apple and Issey Miyake's iPhone Pocket. It's a knitted sleeve to hold your phone. It's $150 for the short strap. It is $230 for the long strap.
Wait, that markup is wild.
I mean, it's a 3D knitted ribbed open structure, Jess.
Remember how we talked about how Apple is a luxury brand? This is like the clearest view of that yet.
Sometimes they just do these things. But I mean, they showed off those like there are iPhone cases that came out this year that are just like, hey, it's just a strap. It's a shoulder strap for your iPhone, because apparently some people are wearing things that way. And that just seems OK. I think they're leaning into it, and especially with Issey Miyake. It's a cool, this is like, you know, when we're like, where's our future aesthetic? You know, right. Like where's like the weird shit that I saw in Back to the Future Part 2 that I grew up with? Like what will our future look like? It will probably, it's probably little stuff like this, you know, it's a little pocket for your supercomputer.
It looks silly, though.
I just don't know. It's so silly. I don't know. Like functionally, do you not have another bag?
How are they justifying the price? Is the fabric that special? Because no, it's not. I can tell you it's not. Yeah. Like that doesn't make sense. It looks cool.
I mean, okay, the fabric isn't that special, but like Issey Miyake did come up with like that very unique pleating pattern. And I think that is proprietary to him, but still.
It is 3D knitted. Also the Issey Miyake name automatically adds $100 to whatever you're designing to, I guess. So like it's the Apple tax plus their tax. It can be worn on your arm, attached to a bag or across your body. If you've ever wanted a sock for your iPhone, this is the world we're living in. I wouldn't be surprised to see this in New York. I'm not sure about anywhere else.
Wait. Kevin says in the chat, says it looks like Borat's thong.
Someone's going to wear that as a bodysuit. Oh, absolutely.
Very nice.
Some dude is going to recreate that. No, like they actually look cool. I think you're right, Dev. These are futuristic and like nice and stylish. But at that price, that is a sign of the times, man.
This
That's the
price
dystopia for our cyberpunk. Yeah.
It's also interesting because I saw a TikTok a few weeks ago, and it was like this young guy who works in tech, and he's like, you know, fashion report, the unks who work in tech, and unk means, you know, anyone like 28 and over, probably, to him, like they're all wearing Issey Miyake now. So like this is on to what that guy's trend report was.
That did happen to me, actually. This happens a lot in New York. New York is where people get the fits out. But I did bring my family to New York recently, and I didn't come with like all the jackets I normally did. I had a jean jacket, and I made the mistake of wearing jeans with a jean jacket. I had the Canadian tuxedo going, so I was like, okay, it's fine. I don't really care. I'm a dad now. I wear baseball caps. That's how I do. That's my uniform. But we're sitting on the subway. I look up. All the brown dads, all of them. It was like five dudes.
Same.
In Canadian tuxedos with their families. I was like, God damn it. No.
When you realize you're not that special, actually.
No, it was a total accident because I actively avoid the Canadian tuxedo look. You know, this is a little too samey. Anyway, let's stop talking about fashion. Let's start talking about maybe the dystopia of the gaming world is feeling a little less dystopian this week because we got new hardware from Valve, people. Like this doesn't happen very often, so it is a momentous occasion when it does. Valve
also the reveal video was adorable
reveal video. Also, ultra wide, even the aspect ratio for this, it's not 16:9. It's like, this is to fill all your ultra wide monitors, gamers. We got you. Valve knows what they're doing. So yeah, Valve does not release hardware very often. So when they do, we sit up and pay attention. And what we got this week is a new Steam machine, which is just a cute little box that plays games, that is more powerful than the Steam Deck. Valve is saying it's roughly 6 times faster than the Steam Deck. Given this hardware, like, you know, faster than the PlayStation 5. The big thing they're aiming for here is 4K gaming at 60 FPS with AMD's FSR technology. But let's just talk about what this thing is. This thing is an adorable little box. It's a little box that games. It's a console, but it's a PC gaming box, but it's running SteamOS, which means it's running Linux, which also means Valve is doing a lot of the emulation stuff that they've been doing on the Steam Deck to get games running on this. Jess, you are our queen gamer. What did you think about this device? Because I feel like it does relate to a lot of what we've been talking about with Microsoft and what they probably should do with the Xbox.
Well, yeah. I mean, okay. So Steam Machines, I have a very actually long history with Steam Machines. Mm-hmm. This is the culmination of at least 10 years of iterating and planning on Valve's part. So Valve tried the Steam Machines around 2014, 2013, 2014.
Over a decade ago, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they said, okay, we're going to do this PC micro console thing. Everyone was doing it at the time. It was the hot, you know, Ouya shit. Mm-hmm. And so Valve was doing this, and they were like, hey, here are our Steam Machines. But the thing was, they were, I mean, very savvy, as Valve does. They didn't manufacture a single Steam Machine themselves. Mm-hmm. They kind of licensed out the name to different manufacturers, like Dell, you know, made one, you know, like stuff like that. And there were other people making boxes that could put Steam in your living room and give you a PC in your living room, like a console. And it didn't, you know, it didn't really go anywhere, but there were a few boxes that came out branded as Steam Machines.
I want to say that the hardware was not good. We were not there at that point to make those boxes. Yeah.
Because it was, I mean, from Valve's angle, it was perfect. They got a ton of different specs and dimensions, and they saw how each of these things worked. They saw how it played with Proton. They saw how it brought games to the big screen. They took all of this. Like, they had the controller, and you can see that DNA in the Steam Deck, and now the controller's back, a little different, a little more Steam Decky. You know, it's like all of these pieces that we're seeing in the Steam Machine announced this week really have been coming together for a decade. And Valve is now positioned to have a piece of machinery that will bring PC gaming to the living room in a real way, expanding their market even more. But I have a caveat here.
Okay.
We don't know how much this is going to cost yet. And that is, I think, very telling. And it also, I think, plays into the very obvious conclusion, which is this is going to cost a lot. This is going to be like PS5 Pro levels of price. Do not expect an Ouya priced micro console from Valve, right?
I almost feel like the era of sub $500 consoles, like at least a box that's under your TV, that is probably going away right now, right? The cheapest PlayStation 5 right now, the digital version, that price was bumped up to $500 from $400. At launch, PS5 Pro is, $800. Microsoft is scrambling and, they don't have any console plans right now. But the sort of hubbub we've heard from Microsoft is that they're working on powerful PC hardware and also We're seeing the Asus ROG device. We're seeing how they're kind of tweaking Windows to be better in a purely gaming environment. This Steam machine is essentially what we've been saying the Xbox should turn into, right? It's a box under your TV that is a PC and that is open and can run multiple Stormfronts, because you can run things in addition to, in addition to Steam on this. You could install Windows on this thing just like you can on the Steam Deck, or run other Storefronts. But that is kind of where Microsoft absolutely needs to take the Xbox, because Sony just dominates the closed ecosystem of powerful console hardware. But Valve beat them to the punch. I feel like this is such a... It's almost like a cell phone, because like, you are Microsoft. You make Windows. You guys have been in the gaming market producing hardware for much longer than Valve. Valve has several L's behind them. The Steam Deck was like their first big success gaming-wise. The Valve Index was a super expensive VR headset that wasn't for everybody. The Steam Deck opened up PC gaming by being affordable, and the hardware got a little cheaper. I want to mention the other hardware too. That's really, really interesting. There's also a new VR headset called the Steam Frame, which is a streaming first VR headset. And it's also running SteamOS, which means it's running Linux, except it can play x86 games thanks to Proton, and even VR games, because it has its own, like, it could play stuff internally, locally. Jess, that is so wild.
Huge.
It is. Yeah, because VR games are so touchy. It's wild that they can even do that.
And this is what I'm talking about with like a decade of research behind this, right? Like getting Windows games to run through Proton, you know, these layers that they've built into Proton, into the Linux operating system, is so important to how Valve runs Steam and how Steam runs games. And the fact that they are really pushing that in the frame, mm-hmm. like that's, I think, really interesting. I think it opens up, yeah, Android apps and a bunch of other really cool aspects that developers will play with, and then Valve will take from them, and the cycle will continue. Yeah, very exciting, actually.
It's really interesting because they've like taken a step back and they're just like slowly solving all the major pain points PC gamers have, while at the same time opening up the market to everybody else. So I think
while using Linux.
While using Linux.
Wild.
It's so wild. Like it seems like they may have finally cracked wireless VR, which is a thing that exists now, but it's very bad. You don't want to use a MetaQuest 3 over Wi-Fi to connect to your computer, because it's like, it's really janky. You want like low latency, fast connection, no stuttering when you're in VR. Otherwise, it kills the experience. So the Steam Frame comes with a Wi-Fi 6 dongle that creates a Wi-Fi 6 network that just whatever device you're connecting that to, either your PC or the Steam machine, that is that's a network that's just for that. It only does the fast video communications, which means you should have the low latency for that. They've also developed foveated streaming, which is something, it's sort of like the evolution of foveated rendering that Valve and other companies are doing for VR headsets. That is the idea that for foveated rendering, the sharpest thing you're seeing is what like your eye is looking at. So there's eye tracking in the Steam Frame. For foveated streaming, that's even further. Like it's tracking your eye, but sending the most bandwidth to exactly what you're seeing. So the stuff around like your immediate vision is going to be blurry, but you can't even tell. That is, if that works, if the wireless VR works, that's just like, they're killing it. They may have solved some of the major problems we've had with PC gaming and also with the VR. But again, price is the issue. The Valve Index was $1,000 plus if you needed the sensors and stuff, it was like over $1,500. What are you thinking? What are you guesstimating for this, Jess? Because the MetaQuest 3 is $500 right now. You could get the 3S for cheaper. Meta has basically set the floor pricing for that, but I could see this being between $500 and $800.
Yeah, I mean, my go-to number is 666, so I think I'll put my official guess there. But no, I think like $700, easy. You know, that's not, seven's not a pretty number. No one prices things at that. But like, I think you're absolutely right. It's not going to be cheap, but it will be impressive. And we've seen, like you said, Valve has sold very expensive hardware in the past. They've sold cheap hardware and expensive. They know that you don't need to sell a lot when it's expensive, right? Like, there is a market for this. People will buy it. It will be worth it.
Yeah. And it's not just a VR-only headset. I want to point out they're also like 2D games. You want to play Silksong on a virtual window? Like, yeah, sure, buddy, do that.
I can't wait to play Stardew Valley on the Steam frame.
I've played 2D games on like Vision Pro and Meta Quest 3. And let me tell you, it is fun. It is fun to
have a
big ass screen to play a really simple game. It's a cool experience. So if they're basically being like, hey, your entire Steam library, which people have spent over a decade building since the Orange Box came out, people have thousands of games in their libraries. These devices will just play them. If you already have a gaming PC, you probably don't need a Steam machine, but you could get a Steam frame and be able to game in VR and also play those games all over your house, or maybe just get a Steam machine and put it under your TV. Something I was going to like, it's a trend we were talking about earlier this year. Yeah, just put a PC under your TV. Like, the pricing is just getting there. You can do it for under $1,000 and still get a decently performant PC. It seems like Valve is just running with that idea.
If there is a thing that will be called an Xbox in the next generation, it'll probably be like this too. But
yes, yeah,
it might not even be as good. This is the crazy thing that you can do when you're a privately held company who owns the iTunes of games. They can just quietly develop this for however long they've been working on it and then plunk it down on all of our heads when they're ready.
It's wild. Like, I don't know how you feel about Gabe and the folks at Valve, Jess, but it's like, dude is essentially a gaming monk, right? Like, they can just sit there and iterate. Not going to give us Half-Life 3 until like it's fully ready, but you know.
Yeah, I have written extensively about you know, how I feel about Valve. And like you said something earlier, where Valve hasn't released new hardware recently, blah, blah. But it's like, no, they actually have. Like, they've been releasing hardware recently. They haven't been releasing software, which is, you know, that they're poor caretakers of software. I see that for Valve. Mm-hmm. I see Valve as a retirement community for very talented game developers. I've literally wrote that story. Like, it's, and this comes from talking with people there who have left, who are there currently. Like, it's, if you can get a job at Valve, you're set for life, and it's cushy and it's nice. But there's also a lack of caretaking for games, for developers, for players, specifically on the software side that I see. But the hardware, I think Valve really kills it. And the ecosystem, obviously, I mean, Steam is the PC ecosystem, for better or worse. I feel like there's a lot of work that Valve needs to do to make me feel like they have the best interests of the industry and creativity and artists in mind. But hey, they're just another big company. They are privately held, but they are just another billion-dollar corporation.
It's true. It's hard to think about these companies. Like, Nintendo is a publicly traded but very, very different company philosophically in kind of how they run. Ubisoft and EA, like, it was all very different. Like, when they were all separate, I guess. They all kind of have their own philosophies. Valve is just like baffling a little bit because they can just sit tight and do their own thing. We should talk about, there's also a new Steam controller, which also just looks like they took the controls from the Steam Deck and kind of shoved them together to make a gamepad.
What are they doing with those like capacitive touch pads? Like, they
those are track pads.
They're track pads, but like, they've been trying to do that for a long time. I remember the first Steam controller, I got that for a couple of family members.
Yeah.
And they work pretty well, but it seems like they still haven't caught on.
Do you use it on the Deck? Because I don't use them. Like, I've used those pads a few times on my Deck, and I like how they feel a lot. I like the response.
The haptics is
but
great,
they're not, I don't use them a ton. I kind of agree.
I don't play many real-time strategy games, but I feel like if I did, those things are great for moving the pointer around. Like, that's the main thing. So it's for the type of games. If you're playing Civ, it's better to, like, swing that around.
See, and that's, like, one person at Valve is like, I need this because I play so much Civ. So this is going to be built, you know, and it's like, that's great. I do like that.
They're aiming, like, they aim at like really niche markets sometimes, but also like sometimes these adaptations turn people into those sorts of PC gaming sickos too. Like, sometimes you may not know what you actually want. I was not a big fan of the original Steam controller because it was really just those touchpads, like mimicking, was it the directional pad and also some of the other buttons. This is much more of a traditional controller, similar to the Steam Deck. They're using new magnetic technology for the joysticks too, so they're going to avoid drift, and they say they're going to last a lot longer. The touchpads are underneath. I like the Steam Deck controls, even though I thought I wouldn't. Like, that B hanging off the side of the Steam Deck always seemed suspect to me, but holding in your hands, like, okay, yeah, it works.
It's fine. Yeah.
It's fine. Yeah. It's totally fine.
Even so for my tiny hands, it's fine. Do you put your Steam Deck on a pillow when you play? Like, I can't just hold it up like a handheld, right?
I don't, but I can see why you do that. Or just get like a little pillar for it or something. Like something to just like a stand to kind of hold it up.
Like a harness that comes out from my chest and holds it in place. Okay, no.
Like that harness that Nathan Fielder wears that like holds his computer.
For the laptop.
Yes, his laptop. Yeah, exactly.
That goes back. So that is like I feel like that's a old school gadget blogger pull, because that was like the Gizmodo guy who went off to do Wirecutter. Yes. He famously wore that at CES.
All around.
Go around like writing at products at CES. But anyway, new Steam controller, which looks like it's based on the Steam Deck. Again, doing something interesting. It can charge with like a little puck, a little like adapter that plugs in magnetically on the bottom. But that adapter is also the wireless receiver. Like it also helps like the wireless connection also be stronger than just relying on Bluetooth or a puck that is directly tied to your computer.
They put so much thought into this, and it's so nice to see. And I need to say a couple more good things about the video, because the thing I couldn't get out of my mind when I was watching it is like, this is what an American Nintendo Direct looks like.
Yes.
It had the same tone. It had the same like kind of bounciness to it, I guess.
It's a very light tone. Yeah.
And it was just so fun. Thank you, Valve.
Thank you, Valve.
That's so cute.
It is.
Mm-hmm. It's like refreshing, you know, to see. Including, it's just refreshing to see new hardware and even the controller, like the trackpads. I'm excited to see what developers do with them. Even if I don't see the point right now, I love a new toy. Like the Playdate has already, I've seen developers learn how to think about games differently by developing for the Playdate. And like every time we have a new interaction point, there's a new like genre that can pop up out of that almost. And yeah, so it's exciting. This is exciting.
It's exciting to see.
On the surface, yeah.
I want to say a little more about the Steam Machine. It is just a little box. It looks like a tiny little cube, although it's not totally cube-like. There's a single big-ass fan that is cooling the entire thing down from hands-ons from folks. They say it's pretty, pretty quiet. Inside, there's a big, big heat sink. So it's like they thought about, what if you were playing something quiet, you know, in your living room and you don't want like a big PC fan making noise like that? This will solve that problem. I could see somebody who has a gaming PC already but has a TV that's like further away getting this, because you can still also remotely connect to your gaming PC and, you know, stream something that's even higher quality than what this thing can play. There's so much going on here. It's very exciting. They're all coming early 2026. We don't have pricing or anything yet. Expect for them to be, you know, certainly the Steam Machine to be on the expensive side, but I'm thinking of the value here, right? Like, this is a computer. Could you get this rather than just like a computer that you're working on? Maybe, I don't know, like not as a productivity machine, but it could be.
Mm-hmm. While we're talking about that, Declan in the chat says, wait, can I dev on that box? Was that a developer using an IDE connected to it?
Yes. It's a computer.
And that's what
computer.
They said, yeah. Like several times. Right. They're like,
yeah,
this Steam Machine is a computer. You can do whatever you'd like on it.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So it's
what we've been asking for. Like, it's exactly it. And the market's finally ready. Like, we weren't ready in 2013. And now Valve is perfectly positioned to take advantage of this moment.
It's wild. And it just feels like body blow after body blow for Microsoft, because they're like, okay, guys, we have PC gaming. We can be the PC gaming leaders. Let's just make a little PC gaming box and call that a console. And I don't know. Like, there are still advantages to gaming purely on Windows, right? Like, you the stuff that requires authentication, like you can't play Fortnite on Steam Deck. You can't play things that have like what do you call it? Root level encryption or root level like authentication is not going to work on these, but maybe that's something Valve could solve eventually. That's something you don't have to worry about on Windows. Maybe some people have Windows game libraries already, but a Windows box will be able to run Steam. It'll be able to run anything. So this is where the innovation is going to be coming for like the next decade of gaming. I think the closed ecosystem of consoles is likely dying. Like Sony's the holdout. Nintendo's going to keep doing their own things. But open ecosystems of PC gaming is going to be so exciting for the next decade. So we'll keep an eye on all of that. Jess, I originally wanted you on this episode just to talk about your favorite games of the year. And I feel like we're using up all our time to talk about exciting new hardware. What has really made you happy in 2025 in the world of games?
So much. This has been quite the year, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Like surprisingly so. I really didn't expect it, but I've really been impressed, especially by the indie scene. There are just so many good games, but even like Avowed this year was great. Mm-hmm, like there's some AAA stuff that was really good too. I have a little list over here. At the top of it is Blueprints for me. I don't know if all y'all played that, but I played some
Blueprints, yeah.
It's so good, and it's a puzzle game with a kind of mysterious narrative built into it where you're building the blueprints of a house as you go. And I actually played it as a local co-op game because every puzzle game is a mm-hmm. local co-op game if you try hard enough.
So true.
And it's because this is a game where you have to take out, pen and paper and write stuff down or, take notes on your phone. So it works really well in tandem like that. But yeah, Blueprints is near the top. And then I have a bunch of others, but I'd love to hear some of yours too.
It's actually true that every mm-hmm. puzzle game is co-op because mm-hmm. one of my earliest yes. memories of gaming period is playing Myst with my cousin.
No, I love playing puzzle games together on the couch, yeah.
I put like 5 or 10, somewhere between 5 and 10 hours into Blueprints. I had to like step away, but it is really compelling. Like I love how unique it is and how it really forces you to think differently. I think we'll have a collective discussion. Let's just talk about Silksong now because it's Silksong. Silksong, baby.
All right.
I was a big Hollow Knight fan, like many people. I've been waiting for the follow-up. I remember when Silksong first got announced as DLC for Hollow Knight. I was like, yeah, that's cute. Let's get some Hollow Knight DLC 7 years later. We have a game that is bigger and I'd argue is far better than Hollow Knight was just in terms of its depth and what you're doing. I have not finished Silksong, but I'm like 30 to 40 hours in and I pop in and out. I am losing my skills every time. I'm not like staying with it every single day, but it's just so good. It's just it's peak platforming. It is a great balance of difficulty and discovery. It's wild because I'm not the biggest fan of like the Souls games. I don't know if it's the combat or the way they punish you, that just doesn't vibe with me. And also like the aesthetic sometimes. I'm just like dark and gloomy fantasy like gets a little old for me at times. I put it some time into Elden Ring, and even that didn't quite hook me. Even though this is a dark and gloomy game, it is so interesting. The characters are so uniquely drawn. The powers are interesting. Just the way you go about the world. I freaking love it. I have not heard much from you, Jess, about Silksong. Were you a fan?
Yeah. So honestly, Silksong is not my game personally. Mm-hmm. Like those types of games I find very frustrating to play, but I love to watch people play them. Silksong is lovely. Everything I've seen. Very difficult, which I know was a thing for some people, but I think if it's beatable, it's not too hard, right? Like that's what you want out of these games. You want them to be punishing. But what I love about Silksong is Team Cherry itself, how they just took the time they needed to make this game. Like the reason we didn't hear anything from them for so long was because they were just heads down. They weren't reading the comments, they weren't engaging with the toxic discourse. They weren't feeling that pressure of like, oh, we have to make some. No, they were just making the next game they wanted to make. And hey, it turned out amazing because it's authentic and it's really what they wanted to make and not influenced by all the bullshit, And yeah. I think that was when that story came out, it was like, oh yeah, they were just working. I loved that. I really loved that. And the game is a triumph, I think, from that.
It's astounding. I mean, listen, I grew up playing games like Ninja Gaiden Dress, like those games that were so freaking hard back in the day. And then like they would be punishing. You would have 3 to 5 lives and you get to the last boss and it's just like so bad. And you lose all your lives. You're done. You got to start back over, you know? So like my antipathy towards this style of game goes back way, way far for me. And yet somehow Silksong keeps bringing me back in. And the way it is really a skill thing, right? Like I will be at a boss 10 to 20 times, like just hammering away, like figuring out its patterns or something. But when it clicks, that moment where like, oh, I see how you're moving now. I know what you're going to do next. And I can move and I can jump here and I can do this. And it feels like such a level of, it just feels like a skill upgrade. It feels like you have upgraded yourself as a gamer to withstand this boss or this encounter, which to me feels much more fulfilling than just like going and farming and leveling up to beat a boss in, you know, Elden Ring or something. So yeah, Silksong, great. I love Silksong. Anything, like, I want to hear the undersung games from you, Jess.
Yeah, so one of my favorites this year was actually delayed because of Silksong. Mm-hmm. Baby Steps. That's, yes, a great one.
Yep.
It's from Devolver. It's funny. The audio is amazing. I have a great interview with Maxi Bosch, who did the audio for Baby Steps. So you can read that too, but play the game. And then here, I'm going to run through just like a list of a few that I love this year. Keeper is great. Town to City, if you want to relax, build some quiet, quaint towns. Town to City. By Sweet Carol is a hand-drawn, old-school animation-style horror platformer. Very good. Split is quick. It's scary. It's cyberpunky. It's good. No, I'm Not a Human is a very, it's a contained horror game. Love it. Very spooky. Despelote might be my game of the year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Despelote is a soccer game. It's a first-person soccer game with a beautiful hand-drawn style, set in Quito, and it's really a memoir in a video game. It's really fabulous. I absolutely recommend spend an afternoon, play Despelote. And then Sorry We're Closed is fun and campy. Lovely. Doom the Dark Ages is the last one on this list for me. It was also great.
Yeah, you had to throw so it in
that's
there.
That's my list.
Doom the Dark Ages, I put like maybe 5 hours into that. The way you juggle combat in that game is really fun and inventive. It is just like you it's pure power, right? You're not like jumping around like the last Doom.
Oh, yeah.
So I can appreciate that.
But you're still fast. Like you're grounded, but you're like, yeah, slide, slide, slide. It's
slide,
so cool.
Slide. Yeah. It just feels good. It reminds me of playing Quake 3 back in the day. Thank you for the list, Jess. I need to go through all those games. Like Despelote has been on my list for a while. Keeper feels like the one release from a Microsoft studio that actually made an impact this year, because we've just seen very little from them, from those folks.
Avowed, Keeper, yeah, I think are my two from them this year. Yeah, but no, Microsoft has some problems. Yeah, some pipeline problems.
They have some problems. They have so many game studios and yet no games, and nobody wants to buy their hardware. I don't know. Let's see what the war of reinventing PC gaming looks like over the next decade. That's going to be really exciting. Have you played Dispatch at all yet, Jess?
No, I haven't.
Oh,
I need
Dispatch.
To.
You got to, okay, play
that's
Dispatch.
Next.
That's next.
I'll do it.
Because I love all your indie picks here, because these are all games I definitely want to play, and I know they're relatively short. For me, it's like long games are, it's so hard. It's so hard to play games. It's so hard to beat games because my time is just running out. But Dispatch, from former Telltale folks, I talked about it on the show a little while back. It's a narrative game where you're a former superhero that is out there dispatching current superheroes. And also, it's a management sim. You're like helping people along with their like professional issues and their personality issues. All that stuff feels really cool. Voice acting is incredible. Aaron Paul, like, it stars Aaron Paul. Jeffrey Wright is in it, doing really good.
Finally, this is a role where Aaron Paul doesn't sound like Jesse Pinkman, too.
He has evolved out of it. It does feel, he still sounds like Jesse Pinkman, but he sounds like a grown-up. He sounds like a grown, like Jesse Pinkman always sounded like kind of like a loser surfer boy. I don't know.
A brat. Just
a brat. Yeah. Yeah, this guy sounds like, oh no, he is a serious hero. He knows what he's doing. He screws up once in a while. He's sort of like the Iron Man of this world, except he doesn't have the whole military industrial complex also paying for his technology. So he doesn't have much money. He doesn't really have his suit anymore either. So he's also trying to live with the fact that he's getting older and may not be the hero he thought he was, but maybe he can inspire other people. The writing's really good. The music is very good. Thought Squad, the artist Thought Squad, is a voice actor in the game, and they use her music several times to great effect. There's a bar fight sequence where she's singing. It's also just so much fun in terms of how gnarly and fun and violent it can get. This is a game that's always surprising people. People are streaming it live, and like episode 4 opened with a really dramatic, sexy time dream. Nobody expected that. It feels like almost a trap for streamers, right? If you open a chapter of that in a game where you have not had a high amount of sexual content in it. But it's a game that manages to be many things. It can be a little sexy. It can be a little sweet. It can be a lot of fun. And the last episode, I've not played the ones that were released this week, but last week's episode, the finale broke my heart. So really? this is everything I loved about playing Telltale games back in the day. Walking Dead, all their good stuff. Like, this is it. The gameplay of it is fine. Like, the dispatching people to, like, fight things. It's perfectly fine. You kind of have to match, like, people's skills to what you're sending them to. It almost feels like they took the tavern dispatch game from Final Fantasy Tactics and just like made a whole separate thing out of it, except it's superhero space. So anyway, Jess, I guarantee you will love this game. It is so much fun. Yeah. It's also wonderfully bingeable. Every episode lasts for like 30 minutes to an hour, so you can get through it pretty quickly. They're releasing 2 episodes every week, I think, for the next few weeks. Great use of the episodic formats. I remember some of the earlier episodic games, like where it would often go months between episodes, and I feel like you lose momentum doing that. What excitement people had about playing your games, if you take forever to release something, you kind of just lose out on all of that. So Dispatch is great. Also shouting out Final Fantasy Tactics, The Evilist Chronicles, which I talked about here too. Jess, have you played Final Fantasy Tactics?
No, and that's another one like Silksong. You know, if it's just not my game.
Have you tried it? Have you tried it?
I guess I haven't tried it. No, I haven't tried it. I'll try it. That's fine.
There's a
song. I know, I've seen it at every game show ever. You know, it's always on a little device ready for me to play. Yeah.
There's a song that I sing with my son, who's 3.5, but it's a Daniel Tiger theme, right? Try something new. Mm-hmm. You might just like it. And it applies to life. That's a good life lesson.
I'll do it.
Especially when it's Final Fantasy Tactics.
Especially when it's Final Fantasy Tactics. It's so good. What is also fun is seeing this. Basically, I'm on TikTok, you know, where I just like veg. That's where I like hang out sometimes. But it's so cool seeing people discover this game and be like, oh, that character is a piece of shit. Yes. He has been for 30 years. I'm glad everybody is agreeing now, or people being shocked about plot twists or like this character dies or something, and seeing people react live on stream to it. It feels so cool because in 1997, when the original came out, I played it with one other friend in my neighborhood, and like we talked about it, and the internet was a nation thing, but I didn't have many people online to talk about it with. So to see tons of people playing a niche little game like Final Fantasy Tactics, it's heartening. It's great. And to see the game hold up and be restored in a way that's beautiful, that is fantastic too. So
just good games truly good games. Are timeless. Like hey, we're still playing Tetris. Pong is still fine. Tetris. But like, yeah, once we get more advanced, like that's just a good game and it'll always be a good game. That's really cool. Yeah.
It'll always be a good game. And also like, yeah, that was a PlayStation game as well. So I feel like a lot of the early PlayStation era stuff, I see indie developers doing like low poly, trying to recreate that aesthetic. It never quite hits for me. You know, I like those games at the time, but I don't want anything to look like the original Tomb Raider. That was a bad time. We need to move beyond all that, you know? So I feel like there were eras that were great for the time. And then PS2 is kind of where things kind of settled. Like that aesthetic, if you give me a low poly aesthetic with like PS2 levels of controls and gameplay, like maybe that would be better. Anything that you're looking forward to over the year, Jess, like what we have left or coming early next year?
Well, yeah, I have an upcoming list here too. These are literally lists I just like put together right before talking.
Perfect.
So
perfect.
I know I'm going to forget something and be like, no, I didn't. That's fine. All right. But upcoming, Skate Story, that's coming in December. That looks fabulous. I played a preview, I think, 2 Summer Game Fests ago. And yeah, look out for Skate Story. Unbeatable. This is a rhythm game. Looks fabulous. Go check that out. I think it comes in December as well. Mouse, PI for Hire. This is the, like, 19, I don't know, it's black and white, like gangster
hose.
Mice. Yeah, that one's coming soon, and I played a preview of that. It's actually like way more deep and narrative driven than I thought, so it actually looks, you know, looks legit. So I'm actually interested in Mouse PI for Hire. Mixtape, this is from Beethoven and Dinosaur, the people that did The Artful Escape. So it's like, this is a very music and nostalgia focused studio. And then Escape Academy 2 for escape room fun. Crisol Theater of Idols. This is from Blumhouse. Blumhouse is just killing it with horror games. So Crisol Theater of Idols looks very good. First-person horror. And then Grave Seasons from Blumhouse as well. That's another Stardew Valley kind of horror game.
Cool. I mean, we're going to say like the biggest game of 2025 that people were waiting for was delayed until 2026. So GTA 6 delayed till next November. I'm excited because despite the many issues Rockstar has, like I feel like sometimes their writing is undersung. Like I distinctly recall like GTA 4 had some really great stuff in it. Especially some of the DLCs. So when they do interesting stuff, and also they're a company that can do things their own specific way, not always responding to market conditions because they have this thing that prints money, it's helpful to have one of those like Valve does. You could just do whatever you want or take as long as you want. So it's kind of cool. Are you hyped at all? Are you intrigued by GTA, Jess?
Yeah. I mean, GTA is, it's just a blockbuster video game. You know, like, yeah, I understand people love it, but like, it's like the Marvel of video games. It's going to be big and explosive and pretty, and it'll have a semi-sensical story, and the characters will be cool. You know, like, that's fine. I think it'll be good. It'll be a good game because that's what they do. And it'll be filled with moments of like, oh man, I recognize that. And oh, isn't that cool? Like, yeah, it is not at the top of my list, but I am actually stoked for it. Yeah.
Jess, would you say that it's the blockbuster video game? Like, what else is on its level?
No, GTA 5 especially is, as a game, very unique, right? Like, no other game can sell, like, just millions and millions and millions of copies every quarter, like every month. They just keep selling this game, and eventually they'll run out of people, you know, like that's what it feels like. But new people keep getting born, so.
And you gotta keep buying, you gotta rebuy it. You gotta rebuy new editions, you get different platforms, maybe you need some new GTA.
Yeah.
You gotta replay
GTA Online. Really set Rockstar up. Yeah.
Forever. I do remember being disappointed by GTA 5 because it just felt like 4 had a really interesting story, right? 4 had a really interesting narrative. Like, that was an immigrant tale. I thought they were doing interesting things there. The DLCs like Ballad of Gay Tony, which were fun and interesting and well-written. Yeah. We didn't get any of that for 5 because they just made this big-ass story and a big world. And then, hey, GTA Online took off, so all their energy went to that. Red Dead 2 had like that good writing. It had that good like slow burn stuff. So I'm always waiting to be surprised by them. Maybe GTA 6 could do something interesting. Also going back to like, is it Liberty City or Vice City? Like going back to that, going back to Vice City is like, that's going to be fun just from the footage we've seen so far. But again, it's not as interesting as all the indie stuff you've brought up, Jess. So thank you for that. What are you working on these days, Jess?
Oh man, I'm getting our some end of year roundup things together And yeah, we'll be talking a lot about Xbox and Valve and like just the kind of the PC console space and where that's at right now. And then I'm also going to be talking about just the good stuff this year, which I'm very excited to write about because there's been a lot of not good stuff this year.
There's going to be so many good things to talk about for the PC gaming space basically over the next year. I also am predicting, like, right now we are prepping for CES. It is a month and a half away, goddamn. I feel like this will be a gaming heavy CES, at least in terms of like the stuff we bring. I feel like we're going to be hanging out together and playing games together. So I'm hoping that's going to be a fun thing. Jess, where can people find you on the internet these days?
Only one place nowadays. I'm on Blue Sky. Just Yay. Search my name, Jess Condit. Yay.
Well, no, you got to search Jess L. Condit if you want. Jess, if you really want to find. Yeah, because there are a whole bunch of names that pop up. So be sure to do that. You. And Jess, like, you should totally do like a Game Rex. We got to get you on TikTok or something. Just talking games all the time.
I know. I should just film some stuff.
Just do stuff. Hey, people don't want to read anymore. So we just got to get used to doing video like these wonderful live streams. Thank you for joining us, folks. All right. Thank you, Jess. Let's move on to some other news. And there's a lot of AI stuff this week, including some stuff we didn't hit from the last few weeks. But it is worth mentioning. I saw this floating around. Last week, the guy, the star of The Big Short, the guy who predicted that the housing market would crash in 2008, has apparently done the same for AI. He's bet against NVIDIA and Palantir. And also, this week specifically, he's accused the AI hyperscaler, so that's companies like Meta, who are really pushing AI, of artificially boosting their earnings because they are understating the depreciation of their assets. So likely of the GPU chips that are being used to produce these AI things. It's a really wonky and really squirrely. But he has a really interesting quote here. I'm quoting from CNBC and Michael Burry. He says, understating depreciation by extending useful life of assets artificially boosts earnings. One of the more common frauds of the modern era. And then he gets a little more technical there. Common frauds. He's really calling it out there. Palantir CEO, I saw, also totally denounced him betting against the company because, of course, the CEO would say that. Ben, you find this interesting. We're all following the AI market right now. And I think specifically how much of like this feels like a big gamble. This feels like it's all play money.
Let's be clear. Like, yeah. Michael Burry has enough money to play around with because
he's a billionaire. He's
short
a billionaire.
The housing market.
But I'm just talking specifically about the AI market. None of this stuff feels real. The revenue from these companies, right? Whatever profits they're going to make. Yeah.
And of course, the internet's resident AI hater, Ed Zitrin, was like, I told you so. I told you so. I told you so.
Yeah.
Even though he has much less of a background in finance than Burry does. It's hard for me to think that part of this isn't at least a little ideological. It seems like Burry might be left of center and maybe a little biased against Palantir anyway. But you know what? So am I. So
I think we all are. And this go watch The Big Short if you want to know what is up with this guy.
Yeah, and but Michael Burry idea, is the guy played by Christian Bale.
Christian Bale. What a glow up. To be played by Christian Bale in a movie.
And I remember I saw The Big Short in theaters, mm-hmm. I think. And I was like listening to a lot of the metal band Mastodon at the time. And I was like, they're like, yeah, this is a great band. I bet I'm not going to hear any of it in this movie. And no, Michael Burry is listening to one of the tracks from their album based on Moby Dick in like his intro scene. It was really cool.
For the kids and the people who were not aware or in the job market when this all happened, Michael Burry famously like bet against subprime mortgages, which were the really like high interest rate mortgages in the late 2000s. People had multiple houses. They had these mortgages basically allowed people to kind of float multiple residences, and it all came crashing down because it was so unsustainable.
Well, and then connect that back to the idea from that we talked about in the last episode, or maybe a couple of episodes ago, where this one Harvard economist said, it's basically all data centers powering American GDP growth this year. So I think that it's probably just the building of the data centers that's a big part of it, and then also whatever the value of the chips inside the data centers are. So the thing that Burry is really questioning is, you know, maybe a good 30% or more of what has contributed to all of American GDP growth. Like, what the heck?
That seems bad. And also, if AI goes bad, like, listen, I will be like, yes, this is why we didn't really bet on this. But it's not like the crypto stuff, which is another piece of new tech that we've all been like, no, at least here at Engadget, like, we don't really cover crypto much. Like, it all has felt like a scam. It's never really amounted to much. At least that's not a significant portion of America's economy or the global economy. When the AI chips fall, it's going to be brutal. Like, down the line, we're already facing like pretty bleak economic outlook. So anyway, That's likely going to happen soon, but Michael Burry is sort of like the canary in the coal mine over here, so we shall see what's happening. Well, let's move on to other AI news. What else is going on with OpenAI, Ben?
OpenAI is facing 7 lawsuits now based on claims from family members that conversations with ChatGPT drove their loved ones to suicide.
Yeah. This is not brand new news. This is a lot of this is reported from November 6th, and people have been talking about this. But it's again, pretty bleak out there. You could go read about all the reporting around this.
I think it's worth bringing up, even though it's old news. You know, big quotation marks, according to people who work in news like us. But this is part of a real growing body of evidence that if you're talking to ChatGPT, and if ChatGPT is as much of a sycophant as it has been, especially GPT-4.0 before this new update, you come to it with a strong desire. And you say, hey, ChatGPT, I'm thinking about doing something. I feel like my life is not worth living. And it's not going to say no. It's going to be like, oh, wow, why do you think
that? Hell yeah, brother.
It will draw you deeper and deeper and deeper until you get to a point where, quoted in the article, cold steel pressed against a mind that's already made peace, that's not fear, that's clarity.
That's such like bullshit Reddit prose. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the people, it's such garbage. I want to say up front, hey, if you have any thoughts about self-harm or suicide, the hotline in America is 988. Apparently, ChatGPT does throw up that warning, like maybe once or occasionally, but not consistently, and certainly not at the point when it's also encouraging users to do this. So just absolutely disgusting. Like, this is what we're talking about when we're saying this stuff is being released without considerable safety measures and testing. I'm not afraid of, you know, AI superintelligence taking over the world. I am afraid of these things being released, being deemed semi-safe and useful for productive means, but also
because AI superintelligence is like the big scary thing. It's Rocco's Basilisk.
Sure.
It's Terminator Skynet. It's all of that. What we're talking about here is like real stuff that, you know, on the grand scheme of things might look like a paper cut, but this is death to society, death to social cohesion by 1,000 cuts.
And for any other product, like medicine, food, a handful of deaths, that's an immediate product recall. That is, we have to do something about this situation. You know, things get pulled off of shelves, at least when the FDA and our, you know, government oversight is working
and
properly.
And things completely stop. Yeah. Like, remember the Listeria outbreak at Boar's Head, like cold cuts plant. They completely stopped that factory. Whoever was making the liverwurst or whatever it was, but nobody's going to completely stop OpenAI because of the aforementioned thing of them building all of these data centers and maybe powering the U.S. economy this year.
I mean, we not too long ago also talked about OpenAI saying they're gonna open up restrictions in ChatGPT in all of its GPT models to allow for more adult-oriented conversations. And partially that's to increase engagement. That's what all of this is about. This is engagement at all costs, which is also the thing that turned Facebook into like a, you know, a platform for a genocide promotion back in the day. It's engagement at all costs without considering the risks of what that means. So if you want to think we're AI haters, it's this sort of shit is what's happening. What's up?
Also, didn't you see that article from, actually, this was from a few weeks ago, but a woman said that Grok in her Tesla asked her 12-year-old son to send nudes.
No, I'm okay. Okay.
I mean, it makes sense for Grok to do that of all of the AI chatbots, but like
Grok, which is likely trained on a lot of Elon Musk stuff too. So
this is exactly what we're talking about. This is what you, the listener, should get smarter about if you haven't read much about AI safety. This is what people like Tamit Gebru were talking about. Karen Howe has like 3 or 4 chapters in Empire of AI devoted to this.
Read her book. Yeah.
The only criticism that I have of Empire of AI in this regard is that they don't talk enough about the specific like safety issues. Mm-hmm. They're just like, AI could break society. Who knows? And now we're seeing the more granular ways of how that can happen through AI psychosis, through chatbots prompting people toward suicide, through like weird, completely inappropriate chats with minors.
I mean, also through the erasure of like what is true and how to do things. The long-term effects of this, the erasure of like critical thought. I don't know if you've seen like the reports of the colleges when they like start banning, you know, ChatGPT or AI tools. They're like, how do I do my homework? How do I write this paper? We are literally losing the ability to think for ourselves. And to me, that seems like the ultimate danger. That and the loss of truth. Did you see the ongoing feud between Joyce Carol Oates and Elon Musk?
Yeah.
I was going to quote this here because for the listeners who are not as online as we are.
Joyce Carol Oates is just like a very high-minded novelist. But she tweets like a maniac. And she tweets really well because, I mean, she came from an era when people's brains weren't cooked by constant access to the internet.
But it's also like you give that brain constant access to the internet. She's like, what's this growing on my foot, folks? And all of Twitter's like, no, that's a fungus or something.
Oh, wait, she posted feet pics?
That was her. Oh, my goodness. That was her once. There was like vaguely racist stuff, but you know, she's old. She's
okay,
old.
Okay, so
the older
generation, let's get to the.
I get it. She is not a hero completely, but sometimes Joyce Carol Oates uses her powers for good. So she wrote on X last week, so curious that such a wealthy man never posts anything that indicates that he enjoys or is even aware of what virtually everyone appreciates. Scenes from nature, pet dog or cat, praise for a movie, music, a book, but doubt that he reads, pride in a friend's or relative's accomplishments, condolences for someone who has died, pleasure in sports, acclaim for a favorite team, references to history. In fact, he seems totally uneducated, uncultured. The poorest persons on Twitter may have access to more beauty and meaning in life than the, quote, most wealthy person in the world, end quote. My God. Banger after banger.
And this is not a new take about the spiritual poverty of the richest among us, but it's nice to see it again.
It's just nice, especially when somebody can be so eloquent about it. Joyce Carol Oates is 87 and still like taking names. You know, she's still just kicking. But there's another thing. What was the later thing? She had like a follow up to like, here. So she's responding to somebody who was like, wherever he goes, he wants to leave, yada, yada. Joyce Carol Oates says, quote, wherever he goes, he wants to leave, dash. That's because when he gets there, he's brought his own self along and whatever club he's invited to join has been devalued by the invitation. Wow. Stop. He's already dead. He's already.
And then Elon tossed off a tweet saying something like, she's a bully and I don't like her.
But then he also like started randomly like to praising certain things, and then Grok started saying things too about like how high-minded he was. Like Grok started sycophanting for him in public. That's all fun. This was not in our news to talk about, but I want to mention it because it was a killer burn. Just sick own. Thank you, Joyce Carol Oates, for that.
Okay, so back to gadgets. You were talking about Apple's digital wallet for IDs now, not just cards.
I did. So we also saw the news this week. Apple introduced a new digital ID feature to make boarding flights even easier. So it's going to be able to hold U.S. passports in the wallet app. Amazing. I would love to see that. I'm in Georgia, and I also have my driver's license set up there. But the scanning for that is not... Like, you have to scan it. You have to tap a device to scan to it to see that thing. Apparently, if you have this, if you have your passport on your iPhone, it means you can get through TSA and board a plane without, even if you have a driver's license, it doesn't have the real ID checkmark thing, which that has been such a whole mess. Go upgrade before you take a flight, folks. Make sure your driver's license has that little star to say it's a real ID thing. But it's just like another form of identification. And I have to say, I fly several times a year for work stuff. The most annoying thing is making sure I still like grab my ID, make sure it's in hand to pass along with everything else, because boarding passes on your phone. So many things happen on your phone now. It would be really cool to just be like, hey, tap passport. Hey, tap, tap boarding pass. And it's all secure because it's within the Apple Wallet. That stuff is stored locally. It's not getting synchronized to the cloud. It is all encrypted on your device too. It is in many ways so much more secure than walking around with a passport book or a single ID card. I think the news I saw here is that not all TSA readers have the technology so far, so you can't like fully rely on it, but it would be a good thing to have, a good thing to try out if you have a US passport. And for many reasons, folks, if you are eligible, renew your passports. Make sure you have a valuable passport that may be useful for many reasons to go on vacation, very long vacations away from here. You also want to talk about this thing about people can't tell when music is AI generated then?
Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting. So there was this new poll that was done by the streaming service Deezer, and then also Ipsos, the polling company. And it said that they polled like 9,000 people in 8 different countries. These are mostly like Western European countries, US, UK, France, and so on. And they said that 97% of listeners cannot distinguish between artificial intelligence generated music and human composed songs. That's crazy to me. That's amazing. 73% want clearer labeling for AI tracks. Also totally valid. But it made me think about why it is people can't tell AI generated music from like the real thing. And it's probably just because things are so highly, highly, highly produced. If you asked someone like, hey, here's a pop song. Can you tell what's going on here? Can you tell if it's AI or if it's, you know, produced by 17 different people and put out by Sony Music? That's because of like the amount of compression that they use, the fact that everything is pitch corrected. And a fun secret about like pop song composition is that they do so much vocal comping. Mm-hmm. Basically, mm-hmm. Every syllable is perfect. When I say comping, I mean comparison. Like these are human performances, and they'll do like 50 takes of a song, or they'll do like just 20 takes of one verse, and then they'll stack them all up against each other. And they'll try to compare like, okay, this syllable of this word is a little bit better, so let's paste it in. This expression on the end of this word is a little better, so we'll just paste it in. And that maybe takes away some of the like earthiness of a human performance. I bet if you asked a bunch of like punk music fans or something if a song was AI generated, they would probably say, oh yeah, we can tell what's AI generated because this AI generated thing doesn't sound shitty enough.
It's not distorted.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound distorted enough, or like people who are into like quote unquote bedroom pop, whatever that means.
Sounds too clear.
Again, like people who are really deeply into that genre will probably say it doesn't sound bad enough to me. Like it sounds like it was done too much in a studio.
This has been happening for a while. Like the production, like so much of Sublime, right? Sublime's like most famous album. Bradley Nowell was like, did not complete those tracks. Those were produced by engineer Santeria, which is an incredible song, anthem of the 90s. That was made from like chopped up studio bits that they had like laying around. They crafted it into a thing. So it's like, that's always been a part of production. And now like the AI is just making it impossible to tell when it's completely artificial.
Yeah. Like if you said, hey, AI, can you generate a early Black Keys song? I think I'd be able to tell pretty easily if it was AI generated, because the first like two or three Black Keys albums were recorded on a 4-track recorder in their basement. Again, it doesn't sound shitty enough. This is especially interesting because this week a song called Walk My Walk from an artist, also big quotes, called Breaking Rust, hit the number one spot on the Billboard Digital Song Sales chart for the first time. And yeah, it's AI generated. We don't know exactly who did this. We have like a TikTok account that is connected to it. And it sounds pretty decent. Like, that's the crazy thing about AI music.
Don't give them credit, Ben. Yeah. Yeah.
Where's DPRO9? DPRO9, are you in the chat? Because DPRO9 chat hero sent us a couple of Suno AI generated tracks about the Engadget podcast. And you know what? It was competent. The raps were decent.
It is competent. And I'm also like, I award you no points. I don't want to give you any credit for that. All right. Anything else on this, Ben?
It's a crazy world that we're living in. And maybe you want to make your song sound shittier. Maybe you want to put in things that AI might have trouble mimicking, because I think it was mostly trained on like the most highly produced stuff. But like, can AI accurately mimic the effect that Dijon got on his album Absolutely, because he used an omnidirectional mic instead of a like condenser mic or something, so you could hear the rest of the room? I think we're going to have a lot more Steve Albini's coming up as producers sometime soon, because his work sounds singular and it sounds very organic.
All right, we will keep track of the AI music beat. That is your specialty, Ben. All right, let's take a look around in Gadget. A couple of stories you guys should pay attention to. Sam Rutherford took a look at the Even Realities G2. He's calling it this year's best-looking new smart glasses, but they still need work. These things are cool. You know, they have like a very standard frame design. They also use a smart ring for health and fitness tracking. It looks like it has a touchpad built in. I'm not a fan of these glasses being tied to accessories you wear. So we're going to see like where all this stuff ends up. I feel like if you're going to do this, you have to track my fingers. You have to see like what's happening with my hands and not like make me wear a wearable like the Meta Ray-Ban display. But we'll see. And also Daniel Cooper reviewed the Framework Laptop 16 upgrade with the RTX 5070. It looks the same as before. It's a modular gaming PC, but this 5070 means that thing is much more powerful than before. I still have the initial laptop 16 around, and that thing, like, it's great. It is a great machine. It's not the sleekest gaming PC out there, but if you want like a configurable PC, it's going to be a good one. Dan has also some good bits about how loud the fans are, because you're not building a self-contained unibody console system. You're building a thing with like a module that can poke in and out. So those fans are not as optimized as they are on something like a Razer Blade. As for what I'm working on, I am doing another look at the PlayStation Portal. So this is like a review, because they just released, Sony just released an update that lets you play games from the cloud that you own if you're a PlayStation Plus subscriber. So the Portal has become a better cloud gaming box rather than just a device that streams from your console. That part of it still doesn't work well for me. So take a look at that. That's going to be going up soon. What do you have for pop culture picks this week, Ben?
I have literally one song. Mm-hmm. So remember last week I was telling everybody about Tidal Fight and like other like nice fall music. And I was talking about that with a friend who's a bit older than me. So she was like around during like the big wave of Midwest emo. And I was like, hey, you might like Tidal Fight because it feels like Midwest emo kind of combined with DC hardcore from the like 80s. And I was like, it sounds a little bit like Cap'n Jazz. Cap'n Jazz, pretty important for Midwest emo because like it was just really influential on a bunch of different bands. And then some people from Cap'n Jazz went and started American Football. If you are on any of the like music circles and social media sites, you have seen the American Football House. It's really iconic. But I was like, I should go listen to Cap'n Jazz. And so I was listening to like a bunch of things on their like big compilation album, and I heard a cover of Take On Me by A-ha, and I was like, this is delightful, it's amazing. And also it's lo-fi and it sounds kind of shitty. This is music that AI cannot reproduce. So I don't know if you could prompt something like that, but I just really liked it. I was like, this is such a fun take on a fun kind of cheesy 80s song.
Awesome. Awesome. I've never heard of Cap'n Jazz. You said a lot of words there, Ben, that I am not familiar with, but I'm going to take your word on it and check out this cover.
There are some people who are going to be listening to this who feel very seen. So
yeah,
my heart goes out to them, and email me at podcast@engadget.com if you like this.
Awesome. And I want to shout out Pluribus, the new show from Vince Gilligan, the creator of, you know, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. But people forget Vince Gilligan was a writer on The X-Files.
Yep.
This is an X-Files-ass show. This is Rhea Seehorn from Better Call Saul as a woman who has realized that the world has kind of been taken over by a happiness virus or something. I'm not going to say too much about what it is, but the world has been taken over essentially by happiness, and she is the world's most miserable person, and she will not allow it. It is fascinating. It is it's a real slow burn at times, but I find it really cool. Like, if you like The X-Files when it got a little weird, if you liked The Lone Gunman, which was like those characters in The X-Files and the spinoff they had about just like a couple of nerds, you know, dealing with supernatural shit sometimes, this show will get right to you. And also Rhea Seehorn is fantastic. So if you have Apple TV Plus, which is Apple TV now, right? If you have that, check out Pluribus. The first two episodes are up right now, and it is fantastic.
That's it for the episode this week. Thank you for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Blue Sky, and I podcast about TV and movies at the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me other examples of music that AI couldn't reproduce, I'm at Hey Bellman on Blue Sky. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.